actually, I took my disclaimer off my slides because I am actually speaking on the guidelines, which are published and are CDC and HHS policy. I will not be providing any kind of my own opinions, really. Well, hi, my name is Pat Sweeney, and I work in the HIV Incidence and Case Surveillance Branch, and I do work primarily on data policy issues. I've been working on HIV surveillance and HIV data policy issues for a long time now. And I was asked to come and speak to you to give you a little bit about the HIV HIV surveillance perspective, which is a little bit different than the STD perspective that Sam just presented. We do have established guidelines, so I'm going to today present an overview of the guiding principles and the program requirements that are in our technical guidance for HIV/AIDS surveillance programs on the security and confidentiality, and highlight some of the best practice procedures for access and physical security, electronic transfer, and data sharing to ensure security and confidentiality, and then try to discuss a little bit of point out a few potential issues and barriers that exist for the sharing of HIV surveillance data, and discuss a few ways to facilitate that data sharing. In HIV/AIDS surveillance, we have a very long history of concerning confidentiality issues. The first assurance of confidentiality at the federal level was obtained in 1984. And since that time, we've really considered a broad range of issues that have resulted in the development of comprehensive confidentiality and security policies and procedures, both at the state level for state surveillance programs and then also at the CDC. We have had practices for security and confidentiality in place for a very long time, but these guidelines were not formalized until 1998, and that first Appendix C guidance was that kind of formal publication. And then those were revised more recently in January 2006, which of the technical guidance, which is what I will focus on in my talk today. So Sam presented some context already on confidentiality protections for public health data, but I wanted to talk a little bit about it as well. The legal protections exist at various levels. So we have these legal protections in place at both the federal level, where we have an HIV surveillance, and some other surveillance data systems have this as well, an assurance of confidentiality, which protects the data that are sent to us and shared with us at CDC. At the state and local levels, various statutes, regulations, and case law kind of serve together to provide legal protections for the data that's held by state health departments. And let me say, too, that for HIV and AIDS surveillance, named information at the individual level are not shared with CDC, but those name linked data are kept at the state and local level. Additionally, there's policies, procedures, and guidelines for confidentiality and security that help protect the data. Our guidelines, which I had mentioned, were cleared through HHS, so they're CDC policy. We also have a practice for ORP, which stands for Overall Responsible Party Certification, and that's part of our cooperative agreement process, where each program, each surveillance program that's funded under our cooperative agreements, establish an overall responsible party who certifies that their program complies with the security guidelines. So that's another level of, this level of certification helps ensure that those practices are being followed. And in addition, state and local programs have their own security and confidentiality and data release policies. I might say that some felt that our guidelines were not as strict as they could be, and they wanted to do better. So, in addition, many areas, and we recommend that areas actually develop their own policies and procedures and have those in place. So all these things work together to, in a variety of ways, to protect the HIV surveillance data. The guidelines themselves describe program requirements, security recommendations and considerations, and best practices. They're intended for state and local health departments and their contracting staff, those that perform HIV/AIDS surveillance activities, and all the sites where HIV/AIDS reporting system, that's HARS or our new system, EHARS, is maintained. And it includes guidance on policy development, outlines what suggested responsibilities, suggested training, and physical security and data security. These guidelines are available at this website. They're available online on the CDC website. If you go kind of start searching under HIV and AIDS, and you'll get linked up to some surveillance, a surveillance page, and it'll have our surveillance report, the national report, and different reports and guidelines, and these guidelines are available there. So the security and confidentiality guidelines are constructed in a way with five overarching principles, guiding principles. The first principle is that HIV/AIDS data will be maintained in a physically secure environment. Secondly, electronic data will be held in a technically secure environment with minimum access. Thirdly, staff with authorized access will be responsible for protecting confidential data. So it really stresses individual responsibility. Fourth, security breaches will be investigated thoroughly with sanctions applied when appropriate. And then finally, security practices and written policies will be continuously reviewed and changed to improve protections. So there are 35 program requirements that are outlined in these guidelines under the guiding principles. And these program requirements are mandatory. And I'm not going to go through each of these 35 today, but I am going to give you a sense of what's covered in these program requirements. As I mentioned earlier, they're certified, the ORP, the overall responsible party, certifies for each cooperative agreement grantee that they comply to these minimum requirements, which are outlined in the guidelines. They state the minimum standard, and they don't stipulate penalties, as they're the responsibility of the ORP and under the purview of the ORP. So let's talk a little bit about physical security. I mentioned that the requirements around physical security stress personal responsibility, keeping your workstation in a way that confidential information isn't on your desk or in the open area, it's put away at the end of the day, that you have procedures in place for handling that data. All physical locations containing electronic or paper copies of surveillance data must be enclosed inside a locked security area with limited access. So not only the paper, but an electronic registry, but other surveillance-related information. Workspace for individuals with access to surveillance information must be within this secure locked area. And then screens, computer screens, should have additional protections, protected from view. Could be way the offices are configured, the way the computer sets. It could be that they have various screens that screen so that someone walking by cannot see the information that's up on the computer screen. The physical security requirements also talk a little bit about limiting paper copies of information. So any notes with identifiers or potential identifiers need to be locked up at the end of the evening, need to be maintained in a physically secure environment. Any output that could potentially breach confidentiality needs to be treated the same way. Paper should be shredded when no longer needed, and the individual policies in the state and local programs need to include some sort of document retention policy, and they're really important so that it's very clear when you get rid of some information, when it's okay to shred or destroy documents. In terms of the data security recommendations, personal identifiers must be removed if data is taken out of the secure area. There's recommendations that we recommend that only minimum information necessary to complete the task is taken out, and it should include terms that are easily associated with HIV if possible. So just the minimum amount of information to do a case, complete a case report, or to follow up with a provider should be taken to the field. Similarly, analysis data sets must be held in a secure environment, held securely by using protective software, and the guidelines make some recommendations about types of software packages. Programs usually share a lot of information across programs when they find something good to use. Security software controls for electronic data include various password control protections, user identification and authentication. Programs oftentimes will adopt what their overall local health department policies are for that and incorporate these protections. Regarding electronic data transfer, Encryption is required for an electronic transfer of confidential data. And our guidelines outline standards or define the standards around encryption. There's a 128-bit minimum encryption standard currently in the guidelines. Ancillary databases also must be encrypted when not in use. And those are databases that you might make for analysis data sets, or often surveillance programs have lab data, separate lab databases that they keep. Those should be encrypted when not in use. Then there's recommendations about requirements, actually, about sending data to CDC. That data itself will be encrypted, and programs use the secure data network for transmitting data to us. Email and faxing of case-specific information is strongly discouraged, and this is something that was in the revised guidelines. We recommend that anything considered confidential, sensitive, or potentially identifying not be emailed or faxed. Now, some programs make the decision to do this, and we recommend if they decide that this is an important way to get information, that faxing, for example, be a controlled fax environment, where there is someone who's set to send a document and someone set on the other end to receive it at a certain time, and it's confirmed that it was received by the right person, so that confidential data isn't hanging around in someone's fax machine to be picked up and by the secretary and taken out to lunch or something. Similarly with email, if you choose to email information that is sensitive or confidential, that email be include that information in an attachment that's encrypted itself, so that if inadvertently the email is sent to reply all or to a whole listserv of individuals, only the people with the encryption key can open it and find out what the information is. So there's things that you can do to make the emailing and faxing more secure, but just in general, for general practice, the guidelines discourage it strongly. Okay, in terms of security and confidentiality policies, the guidelines recommend that areas policies should be in writing. They should describe the methods for reviewing practices and evolving technology, so incorporate into them a method for kind of overall review, annual review, some level of review, so that you can include, you're right on top of the existing and evolving technologies. These policies should name the ORP, and that should be certified annually. And it also should define a data release policy. Now, the data release policy should include things like cell size restrictions, suggested mechanisms for suppression of data, which Jeff and Michael are going to present later, some techniques for limiting disclosure through data release. Those program standards should be listed in the data release policy for each area. The guidelines themselves do not get into detailed recommendations other than suggesting what the CDC and CHS standards are for cell size. The policy should define role-based access for surveillance staff. So it should define very clearly who gets access to the HARS data set, who gets access to data analysis data sets, individually by name or the role, the surveillance coordinator, data managers, other staff. It can include people inside or outside the surveillance unit, and it can also describe access to these types of various types of data sets in addition to EHARS or HARS. So authorized individuals, once an ORP determines that these people are authorized, they need to complete annual security and confidentiality training specific to HIV/AIDS surveillance. They need to sign specific confidentiality statements. They need to accept individual responsibility for maintaining the security and confidentiality of the data that they are working with, and challenging those without authorization who may have access to that data, and reporting breaches of confidentiality. Now, I want to talk a little bit about access and data sharing with programs outside of HIV surveillance. The guidelines, as they are written, have no specific prohibition about doing this. It leaves it up to state and local areas, but there's some qualifiers. The ORP has to approve the sharing of data. And the sharing of this information needs to be well thought out. It needs to be first based on an expressed and justifiable public health need to do this to have this level of data sharing. It should be for a public health purpose. Access for non-public health purposes should only be granted to the extent that it's required by law to do so. The program that the data is being shared with must certify that the level of security in this other program is equivalent to those outlined in our HIV/AIDS surveillance security and confidentiality guidelines. That's always been our standard. It's sometimes difficult to achieve, and it scares other programs because they're HIV guidelines. It's not clearly how they're translated to other programs. But if you read them, you'd see that I think they are actually very easily transferable. The sharing of the information and thinking through how it will be done, it must not compromise or impede surveillance activities. I mean, our primary goal in our HIV/AIDS surveillance program is to conduct good, complete HIV and AIDS case reporting. And so we want those activities, obviously, to be a priority. But it shouldn't compromise or impede our surveillance activities. And it must not affect the public perception of confidentiality of the surveillance system. This is incredibly important, particularly for areas that have more recently gone through very heated and intense debates in some areas around whether or not they should report cases of HIV infection in addition to their AIDS case reporting. Some states had very intensive, very public discussions around HIV infection reporting, and the only way they got name-based reporting was to have outlined that the data will only be used for HIV surveillance and not be shared with other programs, will not be used for different types of purposes. So you need to be cognizant of that when a new policy or a new sharing of data is actually suggested. So prior to establishing these types of linkages or sharing data for the first time, the program should define the objectives, propose methods, specify the data that's shared, and compare available strategies. Is this the best thing to do? Can we get the information we need from doing a data analysis, or do we have to actually merge, share data and incorporate it into a different surveillance data set for it to be useful? Compare the different possibilities. They should also develop plans in consultation with community partners, particularly in areas with these prior agreements, whether they be just not written agreements, obviously, but understandings with the community based on discussions that they've had. This is not a requirement, but it's good practice to undergo some sort of process. any of the proposed data linkages need to be consistent with existing laws and regulations. And you must provide and include ongoing evaluation of what you're doing to assess that the security and confidentiality procedures are being met and are still in place, and if you could do anything more to improve on them. Remember, some proposed uses or analyses of these data may require IRB approval. They may not be necessarily research. They may not constitute research, or the IRB may say this doesn't need IRB approval, but some may, and some local health departments have found this a very useful mechanism for when a new proposal for data analysis or creation of a different data set is proposed. They have a way of engaging the IRB and getting their approval and input on it as well. It's not going very fast. So there seems to be a lot more interest in data sharing. And I think some of it has to do with, there was a lot of information shared earlier in this meeting about integration. We have the OASIS project that Nicholas mentioned. We also, I think it's a number of different things that are happening at the same time. One key thing is that we are revising the CDC Partner Services Guidelines. And they are in the process of finally being published, and it'll be several months, I guess, so sometime over the next period of several months. These guidelines promote the value of using HIV case reports to initiate partner services. So the existence of the CDC document that's suggesting that HIV surveillance data actually be used to initiate partner services is a bit new. But the guidelines, these partner service guidelines, specify that this should be only be used in that way at the individual case level when security and confidentiality standards are met. And this document includes standards based on our HIV/AIDS surveillance security and confidentiality guidelines with some modifications. These modifications, these differences in the document, reflect specifically accommodations that were made to be able to conduct field activities. If you remember the in an earlier slide, I mentioned that no case-specific identifying information be taken out of the secure area. Well, it would be impossible to do partner services with and go out and do some contact tracing without a name. So there are these differences that we tried to accommodate. There's also differences like the physical location. We have some rules that suggest, the secure area should not be accessible by window, which is sometimes very hard to implement when you have no control over your physical building space that you're in. But we actually have it, and we've made changes in surveillance programs. But at the local level, where if a local health department may be conducting partner services, that would be almost impossible to implement. So we've tried to make some of those accommodations in the guidance, but the guidance still states that don't use this data unless the security standards are equivalent. For the second question, has something changed in the HIV surveillance requirements on data sharing? Well, they haven't changed, but I think additional guidance is definitely needed about how programs can approach sharing data in this way. And I mentioned some procedures that are in place, but our guidelines currently are not prescriptive in this area, and so I think there's more work that's needed. We have older HIV surveillance guidance documents, many technical guidance documents that have been created over the last 15 years related to integrating HIV and AIDS case reporting around implementing name-based reporting. And most of those documents stress that the primary use of surveillance data is for monitoring trends and not for case management. So these documents exist, and they seem to be in conflict for an area that wants to consider using the surveillance data to initiate offering services of some sort. So we'll have to reconcile that. I still think, speaking from a surveillance perspective, that primarily our surveillance staff should be doing, focusing on HIV surveillance. But there are these other uses and data sharing that I think could be useful for HIV surveillance as well as these other programs. So we need to consider that more. Also, the other older guidance states that there's no requirement for programs to share individual reports. I believe that standard's still in place, but what we're doing is recognizing in the partner services guidelines, like this is the way to do good, a way to begin good partner services by establishing these initial linkages. And of course, the efforts at CDC, these recent efforts to promote integration of hepatitis, STD, and TB programs and service integration, all of these things have worked together, I think, to say that we're moving towards thinking about these things more, and I think we have some more work to do. Regarding electronic data linkage and sharing of data, these linkages of surveillance records with other databases, semi-annually or annually, to identify unreported cases and for evaluation purposes has always been encouraged in our guidelines. And so that is done by most programs routinely. For the electronic data linkage, when it's done, areas should develop their own protocols that define the minimum information that's required, establish how the actual linkage will be performed and by who, what secure methods would be used, and how the data will be used. It should be conducted by authorized staff, and any transferring of the information should meet the encryption standards for either transporting or when the data are not in use. So how can programs facilitate sharing of data? Well, I think the first step is really to familiarize programs with the CDC security and confidentiality guidelines. like I mentioned, the Partner Services Guidelines will have an appendix that is got these program standards outlined. And our document is, our guidelines document actually has much more to it in terms of talking more about actual best practice procedures. Secondly, I would work to bring program security in line with the security and confidentiality guidelines as well, and collaborate across programs on the development of protocols that prior to initiating data sharing. Think through what you're going to do, why you're doing it, and how you're going to go ahead and make sure that the data are shared in a secure way. Seek input from applicable partners in the community and medical providers and public health providers if you can. And recognize that some of the solutions may require additional effort. Data may not be readily, immediately available by putting some of these requirements in place, but it might require some compromise in that way. You might not be able to get complete access to HARS, for example, but you will get a few pieces of information. Maybe the appropriate thing is to get a few pieces of key information that allow you to do whatever work you intend to do. Very slow. There we go. Okay, so in conclusion, our current requirements for surveillance are outlined in this technical guidance document. Check it out. It's on the CDC website. This document itself, I think, will be useful as programs consider changes in policies and procedures around data sharing. And changes in policies and procedures are a collaborative process, and I think we have to remember that. I mean, we have a shared goal of preserving security and confidentiality, but maximizing the usefulness of data. And so I think that we need to keep in mind that data sharing can offer benefits both ways, and that that we need to work together to come up with solutions for addressing some of the issues around securing the data. We do need additional guidance on to assist programs in achieving these data sharing goals. And I know that in our branch, we're going to be initiating some activities related to developing some additional guidelines. And here are just some data release resources. I think all of them are mentioned. I think Nicholas has the UNAIDS guidelines, which is also based on our HIV surveillance guidelines. But we have a CDC data release, data re-release of state health data, which is an interesting document. It's a data release guidelines working group document, and the CDC policy, which Sam had mentioned. That's it. Thank you very much.
Do we have any questions?
Okay. Tammy, hi. Not a unique identifier, but yes, it's a number.
Whether you're supposed to be
I'm going to go backwards. There's probably other surveillance programs represented in this audience that have great suggestions on that, but one of the, you know, they've approached it different ways. I mean, some still take the case report form out individually, complete it, they lock it up in their briefcase, you know, you just follow the guidelines in terms of the physical security of keeping that information. Sometimes you separate the name from that information, even though it says, and it does say HIV AIDS. Some have modified the case report form so that it doesn't. And, you know, I think less and less areas, because of this electronic age and EHARs, and our form doesn't match EHARs completely, because of that, they've developed their own forms and then modified it to limit the amount of information that's on it. So laptops would be an answer, too, for direct data entry. It's encrypted, it's locked, if it's safe. So that's one response for the field. The second question was around remind me again, state no. We treat state no as, even though it's not a unique identifier, it's a state-generated number. Every state generates it the same way, but it's the number that's associated with the case when it's sent to CDC. We have decided, interpreted that state number is linkable, particularly at the state level and local level, to a name. And therefore, we're treating it as sensitive information because it's a linkable number. However, we realize, too, and because of some issues that happen, we suggested our policy as being no emailing of state nos, no faxing of state nos, no sharing of state nos, even though it might just be a state no in an email with no other information. This has caused grief for our programs, and we know that. But we implemented this policy on an interim basis specifically because our feeling is, if you say, okay, well, you can email state no and sex, the sex code, and then suddenly it's going to be, oh, but then I'm going to add the date of birth, and then all this other information gets added to the record. So it's, in a way, the most conservative thing we could say was, don't even email that, call the person, share that information another way, don't share that electronically. So, but we realize that this is making work difficult, and we need to talk about it more at CDC, but we have been talking about it, and I think we will be putting in place some guidelines that suggest that you could stop there and just emailing of a state number is okay. The question is, where we are very undecided, is what other information would be acceptable, and most areas have thought this through because you have to do this to get your work done, and they've developed their own procedures and priorities in this area. Now, the first question was about the STDMS. Do you want to talk about the new, isn't there a new version of STDMS, Sam?
Well, I don't think it addresses this issue.
No.
I mean, it would only perhaps even do it better.
Okay. Once those are established and in place, the question is, how do you make it happen? How do you add the additional protection? How do you make the computers secure that have the STDMIS data? How do you control access to STDMIS, which, you know.
And if I could say, I'm not certain how all the
one of the difficult issues is, I know, is the overall responsible party has to be at a level in the health department that can make changes in both programs. That is sometimes a stumbling block as well because that person isn't always doesn't always have the authority over STD-MIS or some other. So that's one of the things that we're working with too, to try to identify who is the appropriate person who can help implement some changes across the board where we need to. Yeah. Yes. I guess that would be me. No, we'd be happy to.
One more question? Could you have your hand up earlier? Nice presentation.
Thank you. Well, we argue that the data are actually useful for monitoring. Okay, I'm sorry. They just implemented a name-based reporting, but I believe that there is some question regarding the usefulness of having that data by name if it's not used for an immediate follow-up action with the individual. So an area in the United States, if partner services, offering partner services are using that to trigger a partner services visit or follow-up would be considered, in my opinion, meeting that's a justifiable public health activity that requires the name to follow up with a person and some locating information. But our program in surveillance has really suggested all along that the value of surveillance data really is for monitoring trends and looking at trends over time. And we do actually have we are collecting incidence data in addition to our core case surveillance data, which we are looking at people who are more recently infected and identified as new infections. And so those incidence protocols are in the early stages yet, but those are a type of activity that we do in the state that you might want to consider, but those are ways that we use the data. And the way the follow-up and core surveillance is done at the state level, names are required really to all the medical records that are reviewed, all the laboratory data that are reviewed, are name-based data sets that we obtain the information from, death registries, vital statistics, all of the information that we get from other sources to compile a case report in the United States is based on name. So it's required for us to actually get good, complete data. I hope that answers your question. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right.